It's another Monday here on Political Rewind. You know one way I can tell it's a Monday afternoon, Jim Galloway? Because State Senator Elena Parent, who is a professional in every sense of the word, is still trying to adjust to the day. Just as we're going on the air, she spilled an entire cup of coffee across the table in the studio.
If you hear a zap in the next 30 seconds or so, she's electrocuted herself.
We hope for the best. That's Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He has his column in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays. And, of course, you can read the Political Insider blog on the AJC website, which he oversees. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon.
Senator Elena Parent, you okay over there?
Yeah, I hope everyone's still dry.
We'll take care of that. Don't worry. While you're trying to fix that, bring your microphone right up closer so we can really hear what you're saying. There you go. Senator, we should tell everybody who hasn't heard you on the show, or if they have, remind them that you are a Democratic state senator from the 42nd district, which is largely DeKalb County, right?
That's right. It's actually entirely in DeKalb.
Okay. And back on Monday, because we like having him here on Monday afternoons, Brian Robinson, Republican strategist and former communications director, deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. How are you?
I tell you, you make my Mondays brighter, Bill.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You were being interviewed by Channel 11 in our driveway. Do they want to talk to you about the 6th district race?
6th district race, man. And it is all the time. I mean, it is what everybody wants to talk about. People who are in my business in Georgia are getting calls from national reporters fairly regularly. And there's been intense local media interest, which warms my dark little political heart, because
and probably fills your wallet a little bit too.
Not about as much as being on this show does. Yeah.
So you were being interviewed by their wonderful reporter Doug Richards. What do you know? What time you're going to be on? So people want to watch
5 and 6.
Five and six
on Channel 11.
Channel 11. Okay. That
to get my
great
wisdom on the 6th district race.
We are going to talk about the 6th district race in just a minute. Lots to talk about there. We're going to talk a little bit more about the aftermath of the Comey testimony, because things developed throughout the weekend around that. But I want to start with a couple of breaking news headlines. Two of them, really. The most significant, really, is that a second federal appeals court has now ruled against President Trump's revised travel ban. It was the United States Court of Appeals for the 9th Circuit. That's in San Francisco. And they join a number of courts, Jim, who have now rejected the administration's effort. But I want to read one line from the ruling. The court says this, quote, "A reasonable, objective observer, enlightened by the specific historical context, contemporaneous public statements, and specific sequences of events leading to its issuance, would conclude that the executive order was issued with a purpose to disfavor a particular religion." Judge Watson wrote that. And what that means, of course, is that no matter how the White House tries to distance itself from what Trump talked about during the campaign, the court says, no, that's part of all this.
And remember, we just in the last week or so, we had Trump saying, let's call it what it is, a travel ban.
Yeah, Elena, you're a lawyer. Again, we know that the argument the lawyers for the White House have tried to make is that, no, this isn't a travel ban. This has got to do with countries with potentially dangerous terrorists. And yet, as we just said, the courts are saying, no, when Donald Trump said Donald Trump will ban all Muslims and other statements like that, that's contemporaneous information the court took into consideration.
That's right. They want, the lawyers would rather have the courts only look at the four corners of the document, but all the other evidence comes into play and the president keeps undermining what they're trying to say in this and other contexts by sort of mouthing off.
Brian, the White House has already filed an appeal on an earlier decision by another appeals court to take this to the United States Supreme Court. It inevitably has got to be heard there. There's no way the court can reject hearing this case, is there?
That's right, because it does come down to what are the limits of executive power. The the government of the United States does have control over who is allowed to immigrate here and what that legal process is going to be. So we do need to get to the bottom of where those lines are. And I absolutely agree with Senator Parent on this. The Twitter habit has really hurt the president so profoundly when it comes to real life implications. The Comey hearing last week would not have happened. I firmly believe that, were it not for the tweets that Trump put out that undermined the well-thought-out argument that the administration had put forward, that they had trotted Vice President Pence out to say that the Deputy Attorney General had recommended this. And he comes back and goes, nope, it's because of this Russia thing. And that's what led to all of this stuff with Comey. And this is another example, saying that it was a complete and total Muslim ban. And those are his words.
Yeah. And this is why Kellyanne Conway's husband has declined that appointment as Solicitor General.
And took a stand on Twitter, which I thought was really interesting, considering that his wife still works for the president. So, you know, it's as a Republican, as someone who actually supports the president on this policy, I think it makes sense that we look at areas where there has been anti-American sentiment, where there's been support for jihadism, et cetera, that we extreme vet those who come into this country and make sure that they pass some semblance of American values testing. I know Jim and I disagree on that, but I do think it's important to the future of this country. I support him, and I hate that he's bungling it.
I'll tell you, Bill, one thing that's going to be very interesting to watch as this plays out. Let's assume that the U.S. Supreme Court does take this up. Elena, would that be arguable in October? Is that
That's what they're looking at.
If they would,
right. Yeah.
I mean, so, and the court now has nine members, and it'll be interesting to see where Trump's appointee comes out on this, because if he doesn't come through like the president wants him to, then
he may be subject to a Twitter tirade.
Exactly.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about a lot of stuff involving President Trump in a while. I do want to share with you and Brian, thanks for bringing up the Attorney General, because that's the other breaking news that we have. We do know over the weekend, Attorney General Sessions sent word to the Senate Intelligence Committee that he wanted to testify because he wanted to respond to what he heard Jim Comey say. Among other things, Comey made a rather mysterious remark when he talked about the fact that he assumed Sessions was going to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. And he said, for some reasons that I cannot talk about publicly, kind of one of a number of statements Comey made that you just knew he was poking at Sessions and of course, Trump. But we just learned a little while ago that Sessions will testify in an open hearing. It will not be a closed hearing, as some people suggested. Elena, here we go again. This is tomorrow at 2:30. This is going to be another kind of must-watch TV.
Right, another blockbuster moment. And, you know, it's really... if there is any legislative agenda out of the president or even Congress, it's certainly hard to carry out with the fact that everyone is mired in investigations and hearings and intrigue.
All right, let's put Trump on hold for the time being and talk about the weekend and the 6th District race. We're in the final week of the race.
Thank goodness.
I think everybody agrees with that. Jim Galloway, we had our first Saturday of early voting this weekend. And the number, we had, like a lot of people, on Friday suggested that by the end of the weekend, we could be up to close to 100,000 early voters. And we're right approaching
number. We're right there. I mean, I think as of Saturday, there were 94,000. Only 193,000 voted on April 18th. So we're just about at the halfway mark already. So this is going to be one. It's not uncommon. It's not unheard of in Georgia for runoffs to be a lot more heavily to have more heavier participation in the runoff than the original round of voting. And this is going to be one of those, I think.
What's the mood like? Your district covers a great deal of the, or your district is largely in the 6th, Elena.
Well, my folks are excited and pumped up and busy volunteering for John Ossoff. I mean, the part of the DeKalb that I represent is certainly Democratic leaning.
Sure.
And
sure.
There are a lot of folks who have been out pounding the pavement.
Leaning.
Whereas as Theron Johnson would like to remind us, had he been here, whereas Brian, who lives in the three-car garage neighborhood of the 6th right. District.
Hey, I lived in that neighborhood when I represented the House as a Democrat, I was in the House. So.
You know how untrue Theron's comments are.
let me add them, Brian.
Brian, the conventional wisdom has it that Democratic voters turn out early, that Republican voters come on election day. Yeah. And the argument, isn't it, am I right, it's that Republicans tend to skew a little older. Yeah. They have more entrenched habits of voting on election day. Do you buy all that?
Well, statistically, yes. I don't know what the reasons are, but I do know that on election day, the Republican turnout is better than Democrat turnout. And in early voting, Democrats are much more likely to show up, particularly in the early stages of early voting. One reason why the handle folks feel really confident going into next Tuesday is because despite these polls showing her down by margins as much as 7, early voting has been very positive for Republicans. Ossoff is going to have to be chipping away a lot of Republican voters if he's going to be competitive here, because the people who are showing up are people who've shown a proclivity toward voting for Republicans in the past. So that's why they're not up in arms about these polls too much, because...
Yeah, you know why everybody wonders what happens on this show after the mics are turned off?
Mm-hmm.
Well, on Friday, of course, we had Mark Roundtree of Landmark Communications, a pollster for WSB-TV, and mostly Republican clientele. He was showing us some numbers of voting histories of early voters and how they start off with a majority of Democratic voters but as time has gone on in the process, you have a greater percentage of Republican voters. Now the question is, you also have voters with Democratic histories, voters with Republican histories, and you have voters with no history. And that's where I think this race could be won or lost.
Well, and I think the other important point, gentlemen, is that results from the first round of voting and the polls demonstrate that Ossoff is pulling a chunk of Republican votes.
Mm. About 13 to 14%.
Right, which is not insubstantial.
No, it's not.
And so, therefore, you got to kind of also take that into account. I don't believe that Handel, I think she was pulling between 1% and 3% of Democrats.
Yeah, right. So how do we read the tea leaves on this? Because Fulton County has had twice as many early votes cast as DeKalb County. And the problem is we don't know, unless I'm missing something, Brian, Jim, Elena, if they're coming from North Fulton, they're more likely to be handled.
Well, that's no. Actually, okay. DeKalb is your most Democratic state.
Oh yeah, I get that.
Okay, all right. Registered voters, I think it makes up 29% of the 6th district. Fulton County, really Sandy Springs North, that's 57% of your voter registration. And of those, that's pretty much half and half now between Democrat and Republican. It's your Cobb County that really is the cash for Republican voters.
Right, the East Cobb portion.
So are you saying
and then
that
North Fulton?
Yeah, North Fulton.
Population is right. is a lot more gotten a lot more purple, right?
But going back to your original point, Bill, if Election Day sticks to this pattern of Republican dominance on the actual election day, Karen Handel's got the ability to win this thing for sure.
Why?
Well, because she's competitive in early voting, and then a really strong election day of Republican voters outweighing Democrat voters could put her over the top.
Yeah, I think the way I would phrase that is John Ossoff can win or lose this race on this Friday when early voting comes to an end. Karen Handel can win or lose it next Tuesday.
All right, well, that leads me, though, to, I want to ask you all to give us your thoughts on how are they going to be spending, these two candidates, the final week of the campaign, and certainly their GOTV, their get out the vote effort, is most important here. Elena, one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about the AJC poll, which we talked about on the show Friday, is that John Ossoff's campaign has, according to the response from people who were surveyed, touched a lot more voters, well over 50% in the 6th district, than Karen Handel, which is down at around 25%, I think. That suggests that the Ossoff people have what we knew they did, a pretty sophisticated operation for getting out there and encouraging voters to get to the polls, yeah?
Yeah, very sophisticated operation, good message. We've got a candidate who was able to devote more attention to that for the first round, whereas Handel didn't really have the ability to you know, kind of broaden the number of folks she was really trying to touch that time as much, I think, you know, because she was looking at more of like getting out her niche portion of the vote. And you know what? The Ossoff fundraising numbers have been staggering from the get-go, which gives you the ability to do that.
Yeah.
I had two Ossoff voters come to my door.
Canvassers.
Yeah. My apologies. This weekend. So, and if their targeting is that broad, that they would go and knock on the door of a household with two solid Republican voters, and we never miss an election. The fact that they're going to knock on my door shows that
they've tapped out all the Dems.
They've never tapped out. Yeah.
They're like, why not?
Yeah.
Well, then maybe they ought to sit down and stay at home, because if they're coming to your door, they're not going to change your vote.
No,
and all they're going to do is encourage you, a Handel voter, to make sure you go to the poll. I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me, actually.
No. And you know, another thing that I really am struggling to figure out is, and maybe Elena can give me some insight on this, but I've gotten significant amounts of Georgia Democratic Party mail in this election. I am a huge waste of money. My wife, too, for them. It's really interesting targeting, and I don't know why. I don't know if they're targeting me because I am in an area where a lot of Republican voters voted for Ossoff in the first round. I wonder if it's geographic targeting, and they're not doing it in Cobb and in far north Fulton.
I think a lot of it, quite frankly, is building on the future. I mean, we know that Ossoff gave, I think, what, $650,000 to the Georgia Democratic Party to help him, and I'm sure they would be trying to build those voting lists for the next round of voting. One thing that I have noticed is that Karen Handel still appears to be going on a two-track message, messaging here. She had Donald Trump on a robocall last week. He endorsed Karen Handel, but his job was pretty much to slam John Ossoff.
Yeah, their message was much more oriented towards attacking Ossoff.
Right, as a fellow
Nancy
who's going
Pelosi.
To raise your taxes, and I couldn't figure this one out, that electing John Ossoff would increase crime in your neighborhood. That one was a little bit...
support for the evil, unvetted immigrants, apparently.
All right. But then she's also got Johnny Isaacson giving a very, very traditional, yay, Ross, she's a great Republican thing. I'm sure they're being very careful about who those particular calls go out to.
Well, I would hope, because Trump, the whole reason that, or at least a large chunk of the reason that Karen Handel is in this position to begin with, is because the Republicans in the district are not Trump fans.
Yeah, what did your poll say about Trump's support?
Well, some are, but he barely won it.
Jim,
in November.
Jim, I'll your poll that. Shows a large chunk of people, I don't have the numbers in front of me, are not happy with
I think his approval rating is in the high 80s, if I remember.
No, in the district?
Amongst Republicans.
Amongst Republicans. Okay. Yes.
Amongst the Republicans.
Okay. Yes. Okay. All right, let's do
that's
this.
Right. That's why, Elena. Because, and to Elena's point, where there's a grain of truth in what she's saying is, Jim's right. Around 90% of Republican voters, self-identified Republicans who vote in Republican primaries, they're very happy with the job that Donald Trump is doing. But those people don't get you to 50% plus one in this district. Today, you've got to get independents who lean Republican, who voted for Tom Price and voted for Nathan Deal and David Perdue, to vote for Karen Handel. That's the challenge, and that's why she's got to go get the Johnny Isaacson voters, those people who voted for Johnny, but maybe not for Trump.
All right, we're going to take a break. As we go to break, I want to remind you, there are like now just so many ways that you can communicate with us. You can tweet us, and we look forward to getting your tweets always, at PoliticsGPB. We now have a phone line, as you know, set up where you can leave your opinion on a given subject, anything we talk about on this show today, for instance, or our producing team in the booth there has suggested this question. We're going to talk about it later. Do you really think President Trump will testify, as he said in a news conference on Friday he will do so that he can essentially undermine Jim Comey's testimony. You can call us at 678-757-4472. You can answer that question or any other opinion that comes to mind. Leave your name and tell us where you're calling from. And finally, people have started emailing me pretty regularly, and I'm happy with that. And you can do that by emailing me at bnigat@gpb.org. So lots of ways for you to get in touch with us, and we hope you do. We really like hearing from you. All right, let's take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Back on Political Rewind, State Senator Elena Parent, Democrat from DeKalb County, Brian Robinson, former communications director for Governor Deal, and a Republican political strategist, and of course, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the AJC. One last little item that I thought was interesting. I saw it on the Political Insider blog, Jim. Karen Handel had an interesting group come out for her this weekend. Bikers? It was the Bikers for Trump organization,
Bikers,
right?
For Trump. Bikers for Trump. There are many neighborhoods in Georgia where I think they would be stellar people to have come knock on your door. In the 6th district, I'm not sure that works. I give them points for their enthusiasm. It's just leather vests. And certain areas of East Cobb or even North Cobb, not so much.
anywhere in the district.
All right. Well, look, throughout this week, we're going to be talking about the 6th district race, and there'll be a lot more to say about it. You know, I'd love to hear your opinion on that, but we need you to be honest. Call us and let us know if you are, in fact, a 6th district voter and why you're voting for the person you're going to vote for, or why you did vote for the person you voted for. And we'll play our phone calls back to you as the week goes on Political Rewind. All right. Let's talk a little Donald Trump, Senator Parent. Let's listen. While we were on the air on Friday, the president held his joint news conference with the president of Romania, and producer Lisa Clark turned that one of the big sound bites from that around very quickly, so we got it on the air. But let's hear again what Trump had to say when Jonathan Karl from ABC News really pressed him on the whole question of Comey's testimony and on whether he himself, the president, would testify.
I want to get back to James Comey's testimony. You suggested he didn't tell the truth in everything he said. He did say under oath that you told him to let the Flynn, you said you hoped the Flynn investigation, you could let...
I didn't say that.
So he lied about that.
Well, I didn't say that. I mean, I will tell you, I didn't say that.
And did he ask you to pledge his
And there'd
loyalty?
Be nothing wrong if I did say it, according to everybody that I've read today, but I did not say that.
And did he ask for a pledge of loyalty from you? That's another thing he said.
No, he did not.
So he said those things under oath. Would you be willing to speak under oath to give your version of those events?
100%. And I didn't say under oath. I hardly know the man. I'm not going to say, I want you to pledge allegiance. Who would do that? Who would ask a man to pledge allegiance under oath? I mean, think of it. I hardly know the man. It doesn't make sense. No, I didn't say that, and I didn't say the other.
So if Robert Mueller wanted to speak with you about that, you
would be glad to tell him exactly what I just told you, Jim.
And you seem to be hinting that there are recordings of those conversations.
I'm not hinting anything. I'll tell you about it over a very short period of time.
When is that?
Okay.
All right. Some interesting things to discuss in there. First of all, how the heck did Jonathan Karl get so many questions in? That doesn't happen very often at a Trump news conference.
I kind of got the impression that there was a lot there that Trump wanted to say.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And it was a diplomatic setting, by the way.
Yeah.
So which is, it wasn't in the White House briefing room.
Yeah, no, they were out in the Rose Garden. And you're right. I think it's clear when you hear that whole exchange play out, Brian, and you know because you've been a communications director for an elected official, Trump had things he wanted to say, and I don't think he colluded with Jonathan Carl, but I suspect that Carl had been given a nod that we're going to let you play this out.
Perhaps. Could have been collusion. There could have been actual collusion in this as opposed to a lot of what we hear in hearsay, but at any given juncture in that exchange, the President of the United States in a diplomatic news conference, as Jim pointed out that it was, could have said, Jonathan, you've had two or three questions. I got to move on right. to NBC, et cetera. He didn't do that. So he obviously wanted to lay a marker down on the ground that he has a different tale than a different narrative than Jim Comey, and he's willing to stand by it. And I think one thing we're all, I mean, not only every American, but every citizen of the world with access to any mass medium wants to know if there were tapes of this conversation, because my heavens, it will be earth-shattering, not just for our daily news cycle, but for American history.
All right.
Now, I think this is an example of the president's profound lack of impulse control and the fact that he can't let any perceived slight go unanswered. And that's what's gotten him in hot water from the very beginning of his inauguration. And now, the fact of the matter is that folks on Capitol Hill who are conducting investigations, the FBI, the intelligence communities, and a majority of Americans will believe the credibility of Jim Comey over Donald Trump, who has been a verified disinformation liar from the get-go. So why is he out there making trouble for himself? The man can't get a thing done.
So the question I have for you as a lawyer, given you're a lawyer, is how wise was it of the President of the United States to put on the record the fact that he not only is willing to testify, but he would testify under oath? Is that the sort of thing you'd advise a client to do?
Absolutely not. As I said, extremely unwise. He has the impulse control of a 10-year-old.
You know, the question, of course, Ms. Parent is right, is the question is whether Donald Trump will follow through. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you what, I'm working on my 39th year here at the AJC, and we've always had this kind of practice. We have people call up all the time saying, I'm going to file suit. I'm going to take this fellow to court. You just write down what I say right now. And we always say, no, thank you. We'll wait till you file your lawsuit.
Right.
Right.
And I will wait to decide whether Donald Trump is going to testify under oath. I will believe it when he is in front of a Senate panel holding a Bible with that right arm raised.
Well, we should point out, I think it's really important, Brian, to point out that this is a story that's played out all weekend because it was an important exchange. It should have played out all weekend. But no one has asked President Trump. We have not reached a point where anyone has so far suggested he must testify. Neither the Senate Intelligence Committee, to the best of my knowledge, nor certainly the special counsel, because they're not anywhere near far enough along in their investigation to do that. So I just think it's important to keep it in that context. Am I right?
That
nobody's asking him to testify at this point.
Oh, that's right. So, you know, you could argue that it was there was not a lot of substance to his promise, to his willingness to testify, because he probably won't have to. And frankly, you know, as an American, putting aside partisanship, I would not have wanted to see President Obama brought before a congressional committee. I would not have wanted to see President Bush. I don't want to see that happen to President Trump. I do think that there's a dignity of the office that needs to be preserved, except for in the most extreme circumstances. So I hope it doesn't come to that.
Okay, then the more important question, and one that does have almost immediate relevance because the Senate Intelligence Committee has given him until June 23rd to respond, is the tapes, Elena. Why does the president keep behaving as though this is part of his show The Apprentice, and it's right after the next break, I'm going to tell you the answer. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, he's steeped in reality television and other modes of employment, and that is not translating well so far to the leader of the free world.
Jim, what do we make of
that? What was that deadline you said?
June 23rd.
Okay. On June 24th, he's going to say, what? I never said there were any tapes. I know the answer to that question.
All right.
Yeah, well, he did say in that exchange right after the one with Jonathan Carl, I believe, you're going to be really disappointed when you hear, but yes. I'm going to tell you soon. So that suggests there's not going to be anything.
Newt Gingrich was active over the weekend in defending the president. He set out, and you reported it, Jim Galloway, in the Insider. You have he sent out a mass email detailing his thoughts on the secondary and hidden motives that Jim Comey had in testifying. Do you remember it? Can you summarize it?
Yeah, I mean, basically, he said Jim Comey had when he released the notes that he had taken in some of those discussions with Trump when he leaked those. He told the Senate panel that part of his reasoning for that was to prompt the appointment of a special counsel. Newt argues that this invalidates that reason, and so Trump ought to fire the fellow. I do point out there that everybody has secondary motives here. Of course, Mr. Gingrich's wife has been nominated to be ambassador of the Vatican. And he does have a book that's coming out on Tuesday.
Tuesday, tomorrow.
Yeah, just Tuesday on understanding Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think Jim has probably hit on why then this particular missive was written and why he's busy sucking up to Trump in a very ill-advised way. I feel like I'm just very disappointed. I think he is completely undermined the legitimacy and credibility of the past career that he's had, Newt Gingrich, in the last few months. It's pretty sad.
All right. So I want to talk about a couple of other things that are going on with all of this. There's just something about the partisanship, and I know I'm going to deviate from the kind of very weighty matters of whether the president's telling the truth or not telling the truth. But I'm interested in some ancillary issues that are arising out of this sort of completely partisan environment in which we live. We're well aware that we live in that environment today. So, Jim, last night, by the way, was the Tony Awards, the awards that celebrate the best of Broadway. Brian Robinson saw a show this year on Broadway. We're very
Bandstand.
Glad. Bandstand, which
Dr. Jill Biden introduced. Let me just say, my wife was in the – I was watching the Tonys, and my wife was in the kitchen, and I don't – I just, it's hilarious to me that my wife, it flies all over her that they always call her Dr. Jill Biden, like she's a surgeon, you know? Yeah, I just think it's funny.
All right. But so here's the theater connection. The Shakespeare in the Park, the Public Theater, one of the most celebrated theater companies in New York City, every summer does Shakespeare in the Park. It's an institution for half a century. Free Shakespeare in the Park. People line up for hours and hours to get in to see the productions in Central Park. They're starting, Jim, a production of Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar, as we know, is the play, among other things, shows us Julius Caesar being assassinated, knifed viciously by members of the Roman Senate.
And they've given Julius Caesar a comb-over.
He is absolutely portrayed as a Trump-like character who, according to the reports that I've seen, is, in this case, attacked by women and people who appear to be minorities. Delta Airlines has now withdrawn their partnership, their sponsor of Shakespeare in the Park, and they've withdrawn from sponsoring this particular production. A couple of other sponsors are going along with that. It kind of conjures up the problem we had with Kathy Griffin a couple of weeks ago and the beheaded Trump head that she was holding up. It just, and Oscar Eustace, the artistic director of the Public, is saying, come on, people. We have a right to talk about politics, and you're all being overly sensitive. Well, we are all being overly sensitive, aren't we?
It's a sensitive time, and I mean, this is kind of the flip side of, I suppose, the anti-Sean Hannity kind of move. But I would now, you know, I don't regularly go back and read Julius Caesar, but as I recall, the assassins don't end up coming off looking very well.
Well, no, but Julius Caesar stabbed about 30 times, looks worse.
He ends up dead, but that was all very real and the whole thing. But as I understand it, the Brutus contingent takes a hit on that one.
I would hope so, yeah.
Congratulations to Delta for making this decision. I mean, good for them. This is completely unacceptable. And let me put the shoe on the other foot. And this, I really got to think about this even before this story broke, because I was mulling it over as I, too, was watching the Tonys last night, Bill. And it's very much like what we've gotten used to in the Oscars. You get these entertainers get up there and basically say that 50% of Americans are part of this dark movement, this dark time. And they're referring, obviously, to Trump's America. And 50% of Americans put him into office. And it's so insulting. It is so arrogant. And can you imagine the outrage? They would not be talking about art. And they would not be talking about freedom of expression if there was something similar about President Obama, if they had an Obama-like Othello, who was one of Shakespeare's few minority characters, but a leader. There would be such harsh outrage. There would be accusations of racism and worse against the people who were involved in it.
In fact, the theater has done a Julius Caesar in which the Caesar character is an Obama-like figure, which is interesting, and it didn't cause much outrage at all. But that's really beside the point in many ways.
Well, I don't disagree with Brian. I mean, I think it's in poor taste. The Kathy Griffin thing is in poor taste. And, you know, the less of that we have, the better.
I do want to point out that while it's true the Oscars loves to do politics, last night there was virtually no political talk at the Tonys at all. There was, I think, one or two people made some rather oblique references, but it was not the kind of issue it is at the
I think Brian's antenna was quivering right there.
But, right.
But let me say, Bill, I mean, the one thing, and I agree with Brian to a large degree here. This is kind of that rift that we're seeing, and the New York Times has written about this weekend among Democrats, where you have, you know, your far left progressive wing and your more practical progressive wing, if you will. I mean, the Ossoff, the George Ossoff running in Georgia, and the Bernie Sanders in Chicago.
All right, let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. When we come back, I want to talk about another sign of the. This is actually a much more, I think, in some ways, significant political issue. The city of Washington, D.C. and the state of Maryland today are filing suit to force President Trump into court. We'll talk about why after we come back from this break. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Bowden, author of the bestseller Black Hawk Down, has a new book about the single bloodiest battle of the Vietnam War. The 26-day struggle for the city of Hue, taken in the 1968 Tet Offensive, was marked by intense urban combat and civilian massacres.
It was ultimately the turning point for Americans in the war in Vietnam.
Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind with Jim Galloway, Elena Parent, and Brian Robinson. Let me get to a few of your tweets. Stephen Carlson tweets, zero chance Trump actually testifies. And then he clarified, zero chance Trump willingly testifies. Robin Wright Gunn has sent us an interesting tweet. It would be interesting, Jim, I think, to look this up. In fact, this might be fodder for you for a column. A 2000 Yale study showed that voter turnout increased dramatically after direct contact. No guarantee an R will vote for Handel. That's pretty interesting.
I kind of remember that study, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you do? All right. Yeah. Soma John says, there were worse depictions of Obama while in office. Don't cry for Trump. Celebs of all kinds have a platform and should use it. Okay. We appreciate that. Politics GPB is our handle. Elena, as I mentioned before the break, Washington, D.C. and the state of Maryland, the AGs, both Democrats, are filing papers, we think today, excuse me, They want to force the issue of President Trump violating the Emoluments Clause, which, of course, is this clause we've all learned. First of all, I had to learn how to pronounce it correctly, and then what it is, which is the President of the United States not being allowed to receive gifts of substance while he is in office. And I think it applies mostly. Does it apply to foreign powers specifically?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And now the city of Washington and the state of Maryland are saying the president is violating that routinely. And they want to sue him over it. And one of their objectives, apparently, is to, they will, having filed the suit, subpoena his tax records.
That's right. Yeah. So, well, a couple things. I mean, A, I think this kind of continues the pattern that we did see a lot of out of Republican attorneys general under Obama. So it's like if the political party is out of power or can't get the sort of legislative action they want, or they get legislative or executive action that they do not like out of the Clean Power Plan, they'll try to use the third branch of government to get it more akin to their liking. So there's that, and that's what this is. And then I do think it's also this sort of, again, like you mentioned, Bill, way to accomplish, obviously, what's been a long time goal of Democrats, which is forcing the release of the tax returns.
Yeah, what's interesting, though, the government has already replied to a similar lawsuit.
Right, the Accountability Office, right?
By CREW, which is the, if I'm right, the Committee for Responsible Ethics in Washington.
Yes.
But it's an interesting response, because what they do is they make a very historically oriented response, and they say that, look, George Washington sold goods to Britain. Thomas Jefferson had commerce going with Britain. Let me see, I think even Barack Obama he sold his books in Britain. So how is that different from what Trump is doing? And just correct, I don't think it's just gifts, Bill, that the Emoluments Clause.
It's money coming in.
But I mean, this is unprecedented. We have never had a fellow in the White House with this extensive range of commercial connections.
Thank you for telling me that I kind of didn't quite characterize it, because I didn't say enough. What the suit alleges is that since the president has not completely disassociated himself from his businesses the way that most presidents have, or all presidents have in modern history, he is still the beneficiary of profits all over the world, wherever he does business. And that in and of itself is a violation of the Emoluments Clause. Now, the question, Brian, is whether Maryland and the city of Washington have standing. And that's not likely to kill it immediately.
But it's interesting, the standing that they're trying to claim here. They're pointing to the hotel that Trump has built and is leasing property from the federal government, and they're saying that that's unfair competition because it's hurting their convention efforts in their jurisdictions.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, Elena, by showing standing, we mean they have to show that they are aggrieved in some way, and therefore
affected.
Have a right to
claim redress.
Yeah, it's legal for we have a dog in the fight.
Exactly.
Yeah, let me tell you where they're standing. They're standing in constituencies that are overwhelmingly Democrat, that are overwhelmingly anti-Trump. And what better way to defend yourself against a possible primary from the left in the next election than to take on the left's greatest boogeyman? And that's all this is. They ought to be embarrassed. They ought to be called out for this. Look,
you talking about Chris Carr in Georgia?
I think Chris has been very above board.
He's talking about the Attorney General of Georgia. But Brian, okay, so that...
But you know, an Attorney General did go after President Obama, but on policy. It was on the Clean Waters of America Act, whatever it is. It was on Obamacare. It was on policy. And let me add, the Republican attorneys general often won in court because the Obama administration did overreach so very
well. Well,
one
thing, though, that I'm actually happy about with this lawsuit is that Trump's various entanglements in the foreign affairs space do have, in other countries, have big repercussions and impacts with foreign affairs. For example, this fight he managed to get himself in the middle of going against Rex Tillerson on Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And you know, plenty of commentators out there are saying he blindly is like tweeting off angrily at Qatar, not knowing what he's talking about. And it's because the Saudis just flattered him and because they're spending lots of money at the Trump Hotel. And would any of us be surprised if that were indeed the case? So maybe it is good to bring a little attention to this issue.
Well, we're going to watch how this plays out. But here's what the larger question for me about this, and I'd love to get your response, is I mean, even if you assume this is a legitimate suit, and I'm willing to say, OK, we'll let the courts play that out. But Jim, we are in the same way that Obama was under siege from the very beginning of his days in the White House for various reasons, including Donald Trump himself with all of the citizenship stuff. This seems to be a piece of the larger picture in which there are going to be efforts throughout his tenure to undermine his ability to lead.
And quite frankly, yeah. I think it's going to be a permanent part of American politics going forward.
Right. Regardless of whether it's Trump or Obama in the White House.
And to Brian's point, yes, of course, Maryland is a heavily Democratic state. What's the other one that was
D.C.
in
D.C.? D.C. Washington.
D.C.
Which is 9-1.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, when you were talking about all these policy statements, the attorneys general, the state attorneys general who were filing those lawsuits were from majority Republican states. They were running for re-election. That's how this works.
Yeah, they lined up the day the ACA passed. Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia was waving around.
Absolutely.
Getting ready for his gubernatorial bid, which he soundly lost.
And I don't say that it's bad politics for those Republicans to have done that. Where I'm drawing the distinction isn't on whether or not it's political. It's on the legitimacy of it. Those attorneys general, the Republican ones going up against Obama, were doing it on policy, on constitutional questions that they had standing to object to on behalf of their states. Whether or not Donald Trump is taking improper payments from foreign governments is not an issue of the state of Maryland, in my opinion.
Well, and what they are arguing is, I don't know that this is in the court documents that they file, but certainly they're talking about it with the media, is that Congress is unwilling to investigate this. The Oversight Committee in both House and Senate have already said, no, we're not going to talk about it. So they feel as if somebody's got to take a look at
this. Yeah, I mean, look, you know, they may not have standing, but I mean, the Donald Trump financial situation is a total morass. Ethics lawyers on both sides of the aisle have said from the get-go, this is unprecedented, this is terrible, this is unethical. He thumbs his nose at all that. So there you go. Now these attorney generals are taking action.
I don't mean to cut you short, but I want to, in the final few minutes we have, bring this back to Georgia. Jim, there was a strange episode over the weekend with a newly declared candidate for the Republican nomination for governor. Michael Williams went to a rally. He's a state senator. He's a colleague, been a colleague of yours.
Absolutely,
right?
That's right.
Okay, and also one of Trump's biggest. He was a chairman of the campaign.
Well, it's all very interesting, Bill, because recall that Senator Williams' strategist and consultant was brought on early on by the Trump campaign, if I'm correct.
That's
and
right.
Then Michael did get the backing, and I never really talked to Senator Williams, who I really like a lot and have a great fondness for, about this. But I had always thought it was sort of that sort of partnership that he had with Seth Weathers that maybe brought him on early.
The consultant. Okay, but let's not get ahead of the story. The story is that he went to a rally in Piedmont Park.
We had a series of national rallies against
the non-existent threat.
Against the alleged threat posed by Sharia law within the religion of Islam.
Yeah.
And the groups were, let's say that they were participating in Georgia's open carry tradition to a very large extent.
Right. One of my friend's husbands went jogging, and I had dinner with her on Saturday night, and she was like, "You will not believe what my husband encountered." And she was just shocked and blown away and devastated by machine guns
and Michael Williams, who's running for governor, was very happy to pose with them, posing with their weapons.
Yeah, there's a photograph that you have online at Political
Insider.
And
this is kind of act number two. This is a guy who he has been in the race 10 days, I think.
Something like that.
Thursday week was when he joined it. On his second day in the race, he stood in front of the state GOP convention and truly condemned the ruling GOP class as rather dishonest charlatans.
Yeah. Seth Weathers gave a quote to Greg Bluestein, your colleague mm-hmm. Greg Bluestein. Again, Seth Weathers running the campaign. We don't know about the supposed symbolism of the group that he posed with, which is called the Georgia Security Force 3%ers.
Right.
Only that a bunch of liberal hate groups were tweeting about it online. This is the stupidest thing in the world. He's referring to the fact that the militia members are holding up three fingers, which some say is a symbol of the right-wing hate groups.
Well, and in fact, it's more of an allusion to their claim that only 3% of the American Revolution
that's
soldiery.
Their claim. That's what they say. That's what they say it means. But the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League have pegged this organization as a hate group.
That's right. So some people are arguing that it's a white power group, a white nationalist group. And look, I understand you get invited to speak to these things and you don't always know all about them. You don't have a huge campaign staff to do research, et cetera. They're holding a symbol that you've never seen before and you don't know what it is. I get all that, man. I've been there. My problem is with the response being basically, this is stupid. No, it's not stupid. If you're opposing the people using white power symbols in the photo with you, no, that's not stupid. It's a legitimate question. And the proper response is, we had no idea what that meant. This is not reflective of our values. We believe in the rights and equality of every Georgian. That is the proper response.
Well, Brian is 100% correct there. What an astute commentator you've invited to be on your show here, Bill. But, you know, I mean, even beyond that, I just think it's a colossal mistake to even appear with regardless of the symbol, a group that is representing a very, very fringe viewpoint, you know, parading around with long guns in the park to protest a nothing issue. There's no Sharia law in Georgia.
All right, we're out of time. Here's what I think is interesting, too, about this in the longer run. I think, unless somebody comes along who's even more to the right, Michael Williams has staked out where he stands on the right in this.
It's not been his persona race in the Senate, which is what's fascinating to me as his colleague. That has not been his Senate persona.
So you're saying it's all put on? It's okay if you
I think this was a strategic mistake,
error. All right. That's it. We are out of time. State Senator Elena Parent, Brian Robinson. Monday, if it's Monday, it's Brian Robinson Day.
That's
at Political
right.
Rewind. And, of course, Jim Galloway. It's such a pleasure that you're part of this on Mondays and Fridays. We'll be back again on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. In the meantime, you can subscribe to our podcast if you can't be with us on Wednesday at 2 o'clock, and you can hear the show whenever you want to, or listen to it on the Political Insider blog at the AJC. What's that? Jenny is trying to get my attention, but you know what? We have about 10 seconds to say goodbye, so goodbye. We'll see you again on Wednesday.